Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that believes there's power in a union. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
And also with us is Francis Clark. Hello, Francis.
Hello, great to be here.
So Francis is a Bon Vivant activist and on the UCU committee at the University of Birmingham and also a Unison campaigner as well. And Francis is here to talk about the long-running campaign for a living wage at the University of Birmingham, and we'll talk about that after this very jaunty theme tune. Is there strike action taking place at the university?
Yeah, thank you, first of all, for inviting me onto the podcast. I should say that the strike action is a long time coming. Many of us who have worked in the public sector and experienced the last 9 years of austerity were well used to falling wages, wages that don't keep up with prices, attacks on our pensions and other benefits. That's been applied very broadly across our economy. I think in the university sector, what people perhaps don't appreciate is that the university sector hasn't been hit by austerity in quite the same way. There's actually been an injection of money into the sector, particularly capital funding. You'll probably no doubt be familiar with lots of shiny new buildings on campuses, not just in Birmingham, but across the sector. Student accommodation, notably, looking fancier than you and I probably remember. And so what you have somewhat unusually is a situation where staff, particularly support staff who Unison represent at the University of Birmingham, really finding themselves struggling, having below inflation pay settlements year on year, at the low end of the pay scale, having to take on two and three jobs. And we've got members who talk to us about having to go to food banks, working in a burger van at the weekend, balancing that with childcare. And at the same time, what they're seeing is almost what can sometimes feel like an unlimited spend on shiny new buildings, the university executives awarding themselves 5% plus pay settlements and more, runaway inequality between the haves and the have less. And so I think that's created the conditions of extreme frustration. To put that in the mix, what's led to this recent round of strike action, and there's been 6 days so far and it's continuing, is a feeling that staff concerns aren't really being listened to. So the current round of strike days actually relates to the 2018-19 pay negotiations. So we've already slipped through that entire year, so over a year of negotiating on this, and we're into the next cycle. So typically negotiations are settled, and then there's a bit of a back payment situation. I'm sure as a teacher, Corey, you're probably familiar with that. And so that's kind of symptomatic that there has been almost negotiating activity, but very, very little movement. And I should stress that as both a member of UCU, which is the Union for Academics and Academic-Related Staff, so generally better paid members of staff at the university, it's not just happening to support staff, such as Unison, but it's also all the way along the line. So we're seeing that with lecturers, with researchers, experiencing a decline in their pay, but also a worsening of their quality of life, really. Excessive workloads, short-term contracts, people working on 9-month contracts, lecturers finding themselves having to go work in supermarkets over the summer. And you can imagine the struggle in terms of paying for your 12-month tenancy on a 9-month contract. So I think those combination of seeing some people doing very, very well out of the system and other people struggling have probably created the conditions where people are saying, we need to really do something now.
I was news editor of Redbrick, which was it still is the Birmingham student paper back in the early 21st century. And we ran a story, this is probably about 2005-06, I think, about the then Vice-Chancellor had got a pay increase to, I think, £250,000 a year. And the headline I was very proud of at the time was Vice-Chancellor Pals on the Pounds. And that, I think, salary was double the Education Secretary's salary at the time. It's more than the Prime Minister was being paid. But the salary now for David Eastwood, the Vice-Chancellor, is £440,000 a year, I think I'm right in saying.
Yes, as of the last financial report, that's his base salary.
and that, and there's other things on top of that, like I think a chauffeur and a rent-free house. I believe a wardrobe allowance, I think I'm right in saying as well.
Gets a rent-free house and a wardrobe allowance.
Yeah.
That's a new one on me with the wardrobe allowance. Oh. And obviously, probably fair to say that in Unison's campaign, you know, the figure of David Eastwood has loomed large.
Mm. There's lots of nice mocks up of him with a cowboy hat on, which I'm guessing they're mocked up and not just taken out of context.
I couldn't possibly comment. Yeah, I mean, I think the salary paid to David Eastwood is symptomatic of what we're talking about, that runaway salaries at the top, while other members of staff are being told that they have to accept a squeeze on their living standards and be grateful. Most recently, again, as speaking as a UCU committee officer, the university imposed a 1.8% pay rise. And if you could see me, I'd be using quotes for the rise. So that's lower than obviously the rate of inflation. It's lower than the below inflation pay rise that was awarded and again imposed last year of 2%. So we're on a downward trajectory. And I think there is definitely a feeling of what will it be next year? Will it be 1%? At the same time as we're being told in the wider economy, average settlements are now at 3.9%. You can, different ways to skin a cat, and some will say, well, that doesn't take account of performance bonuses, and there's lots of sleights of hand. But that gives you an idea that, are we saying that staff who are in a, you know, world leading educational institute with many millions of pounds of surplus, a fantastic reserve, I think estimated around £1 billion, aren't worth at least an inflationary pay rise?
Well, I think £1 billion reserve is probably more than the Birmingham City Council's got at the moment, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say, because like you alluded earlier to the fact that, you know, Birmingham University and as well as other universities have kind of like invested heavily in, you know, shiny new buildings, shiny new infrastructure and things like that. And you've just outright said there's £1 billion, was it surplus of in effect or?
Approximately, yeah. I mean, that kind of gives you an idea. I suppose what we're trying to get at is that whatever your opinion of whether austerity was necessary, and I would say as a Labour activist, it was my feeling very much it was a political choice at all times. Just to point out that higher education is not in the same position as other public, I use the term in the loosest sense, but what people would see as public services or public missions.
So what's the university's justification? What are they saying as the reason for why they can't actually deliver more, higher percentage increases to salaries and things like that? Because traditionally with these sorts of things, they normally go, oh, it's too expensive. But if we know for a fact that there is this surplus which is available, as well as probably other kind of like reserves as well.
I should stress that my primary role at the university is as a committee member for UCU, mm-hmm. and we show solidarity with Unison. So essentially I've been supporting them in an extended working group capacity. Yeah. So I don't speak on behalf of the branch. From the conversations I've had with fellow trade unionists, we do sometimes struggle to get a straight answer on this. So we hear different things, and I suppose it's probably helpful to look at the public statements, because otherwise we could engage in a lot of speculation. Yeah. A few different lines on this. So I think the living wage accreditation, I think, is really important, because that's something which has really galvanised people, has galvanised wider social movements. You know, I think we've drawn a lot of inspiration from Citizens UK, which I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with, who do broad-based organising. You're working with, yes, political activists, but also community leaders, faith groups and so on, and this idea of the living wage is really latched upon the idea that everyone, regardless of what job you do, deserves to be paid enough to live on. I think certainly a lot of people would agree with that. The university says it already pays the living wage. This is the first line they say. First of all, they say the living wage that we're talking about, the real living wage, not the government's national living wage.
Yeah, so this is a good thing to kind of say. So there's the living wage that the government, George Osborne called the living wage.
Yeah.
And then there's the living wage that campaigners are campaigning for, isn't there? And which is higher than the government's living wage.
Yes.
And then there's an accredited living wage employer.
Of course, yeah. It does all get quite complicated. I think the way I explain it is that 1999, the national living wage... I'm doing it. Thank you, George Osborne, for another thing you've got. So thank you for... There's the national minimum wage. And that is a sort of legal baseline below which no one should be paid any less. And obviously there are notorious cases, thinking about poor, unfortunate people who are exploited in this city. You know, the terrible cases of people who have been trafficked and paid less than the living wage. Just dreadful. So there's the national minimum wage. And then that was rebranded by George Osborne because of the success of the campaigns, I think, of the living wage as a national living wage, and he was almost trying to steal the clothes of that. And
classic George.
Yeah, and there's a number of caveats to the national living wage in that, similar to the minimum wage, there are age restrictions, so people under 25 get paid less, despite the fact that obviously under the coalition government's watch, and now the Conservatives, there's been a lot of action around access to benefits, notably housing benefit, restricting that to people who are under 25. So it's an interesting double whammy. You pay less and you have less access to housing benefit. The real living wage, as it's simply called, is independent of government. And it's calculated, I believe, by experts, researchers in the Resolution Foundation, which again, some of your listeners may be aware of, who do a lot of work around investigating causes of low pay, investigating the economy, whether it's broadly speaking working for everyone. The whole point of the real living wage, which linked to that is the idea of accreditation, is that just like if you sign up to use only fair trade products in a cafe, you're making a long-term commitment to do the right thing. So what Unison are asking and what UCU in supporting in solidarity with Unison are saying, you already say you're paying it, let's go that extra step, lock in those benefits, a credit, so that we don't have to worry about this from year on year, because we believe the only reason that the university is even matching this figure, which is just over £9 an hour, it's not a luxury standard of living, it really is enough to get by, but instead they're saying, well, we'll voluntarily pay it, and there's notional commitments to match it for a number of years in future. But as we've seen recently, most recently with the postal workers dispute, agreements can come and go. And an agreement you think you've had one year can soon be removed the next year. If we're all in good faith wanting to pay people at least enough to live on, I think we would all agree that's a decent thing to do. Let's lock it in.
So an accredited living wage, it locks it in and says, right, we are committed to paying a certain thing.
Correct.
But there's other things as well, aren't there, if you're an accredited living wage employer that you also then have to do.
Similar to, again, fair trade accreditation, there would be no use if you were a fair trade cafe and you still occasionally bought hot chocolates which weren't fair trade. It would be seen as going against the spirit of what you're doing. With accreditation comes a commitment to work with the Living Wage Foundation, which came out of Citizens UK, so it came out of this campaigning origins. Work with them to come up with a plan to how you can apply the living wage across your business. So what that means, looking at your supply chains, just like anyone with a commitment to ethical procurement, again, our ex-local government officer, I'm all too well aware of this and how challenging that is, but it's saying you will work with the Living Wage Foundation. You don't have to get there overnight, but you're making a long-term commitment to get this right. So we're going to say, okay, we pay our directly employed staff the living wage, but what about the electrician who we get in 3 times a year to check that the kettle is still working? Is that electrician and the company he works for or she works for paying the living wage? And then the commitment would be to go to them and say, hey, we've got this, we've signed up to this, we want you to sign up to this now. Let's look at how we can get there together and make a realistic plan of it. And this really applies, I've got to stress this, this has real salience at the university, because one of the kind of key antagonisms related to the dispute is the treatment of the hotel staff as part of what's called Edgbaston Park Hotel and Conference Centre. So the university, like a lot of universities and public sector organisations, provides conferencing facilities, and I'm sure you're all familiar with schools and councils leasing meeting rooms, which is all good things to do. However, the university chose to, as part of its sort of refurbishment and again another building, chose to set up the hotel and conferencing park as a subsidiary company. And that involved the transfer of existing, let's call them hospitality staff, into this company under what's called TUPE, so transferring them over. So the first generation of staff retain their rights, or broadly speaking, retain the same pay and conditions as if they were university staff. But everyone who comes after them, there is no obligation on the hotel subsidiary company. I should stress that the hotel company, many members of senior management sit on this board. My understanding is it pays back its revenues back to the university. It is a subsidiary rather than a separate company. And yet you could have two cleaners, one cleaner who came over last year, being paid the university level equivalent to the real living wage, the newly recruited cleaner could be paid merely the national living wage, which is what the university hotel pays at the moment. That discrepancy creates a two-tier workforce. And I'm sorry to say that I think one of the drivers of strike action is that, as unfortunate and regrettable as that is at the moment, we haven't seen the worst of it yet, because what the history of outsourcing shows, and I know as a local government, former local government officer, is generally speaking, the outsourced company, or in this case, the subsidiary company, agrees to match for a period of time, and then try to be charitable, the pressures of a competitive market intervene, and that we see a divergence of those pay in terms and conditions. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility. In fact, it's entirely likely that that same cleaner in 2 and 3 years' time will gradually drift away from the pay scales of the university. And that's made more likely by the university management's, or the hotel management's, decision not to recognise the same unions that the university has been dealing with for decades. So that immediately rings alarm bells, because if you're committed to good faith bargaining on terms of terms and conditions, why would you refuse to recognise the unions for already low paid staff? That suggests that you're not interested in listening to those concerns, or certainly not in a way that would be an effective mechanism.
And if the university was an accredited living wage employer, there wouldn't be opportunities for that backsliding, if we can put it like that, because the company would have to, that subsidiary company would have to be a living wage employer as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's our understanding. None of us are experts. And I think what we want to do is, by making a commitment to accreditation, we believe that that is the case. But again, don't think any of us, we all are very proud. I should stress that we're very proud and hardworking members of staff. We want the university to do well. We're proud of it. We're not curmudgeons. We like to work in shiny buildings, and we like the fact that students are having a fantastic experience. It's about making things better for everyone. I think that's our view. And so we would be open to the discussion, but we want to have that conversation. What are the barriers to accreditation? What we do know is that we've had fantastic support from the city's MPs and Labour MPs and Labour councillors, and also the candidates in the West Midlands Metro Mayor contest have also shown tremendous solidarity. So it's about being honest with people. What are the challenges? No one is expecting an organisation the size of the university to change overnight, but we do want to go on that journey together. We don't want to be shut out.
Should we have a talk about that? So yeah. What have you had from local MPs? And what about students as well? Because there's a sort of thinking that maybe students are a little bit more less political than they used to be. So what has the reaction been?
I think I'll start with the students, if I may, because actually that's a really interesting one. As a member of staff, being at the university coming up just over 2.5 years, I was kind of interested to see how the university sector has changed from my time as a student in Sheffield in the early 2000s. It is true that the student experience, that's a term you'll hear a lot from university senior management, you know, that we mustn't endanger the student experience and it's all about the student experience. But actually, I think when you talk to students, particularly when we have the chance to have an honest conversation, there is a lot of support and latent support and sympathy. So, you know, the university is very successful and we're proud of that. So I think a lot of students who obviously have also had to sort of take on significant financial commitments to be here would imagine that the staff who are teaching them, and also the staff who are supporting them, you know, serving their food, are well taken care of. And, you know, for our members, so I'm an academic related member staff, so I work in an office setting rather than as a teacher or a researcher. But when you talk to my committee members who do talk to students, and they, do you know that many of us are hourly paid? We don't actually have what you might consider a secure employment. They're shocked. And I think the people who have got such a responsibility for their education, so there's an self-interest, the idea that they might be struggling over the summer and fetching about for the next contract or the next job, if only from enlightened self-interest, they're like, we want our lecturers to be secure so that they can focus on teaching us.
Is hourly paid essentially a bit like 0 hours contracts?
Yeah, so hourly paid is closest to a 0 hours contract. It's also termed sometimes called sessional. So yeah, let's say you're recently completed a PhD, or you're in the process of completing your PhD, and that you teach certain modules, and that you're picking up teaching here and there. And it is a contract in one sense, but it's not necessarily a contract that many of us would want. A good example, I won't mention this person's name, but a fellow committee member was given an assurance that they would be teaching come the autumn term, but I think with a week to go, they still hadn't received written confirmation of what they would be teaching. So the assurances are all there. They've taught before. They're not brand new, but that's very worrying when you're maybe relying on that money. Most of us relying on that money to pay the rent or the mortgage. That creates stress and anxiety. So they're the most vulnerable, I'd say. But you've also got commonly, we've done a lot of campaigning. I've got to give a shout out actually to a self-organized group on campus called Precarious Brum.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a group of, as the name suggests, sort of precarious, that we could use the term precarious. So people who you wouldn't typically think of as being economically insecure. So very well educated, often postgraduate qualified. People who went to university and have been sold the line that they're going to have a very successful, rewarding career, but there they are struggling. Said we've been fighting against 9-month contracts, and I'm pleased to say we've had assurances from the university that they will be eliminated. But you've also got situations where people year on year get 12 months and they want to be made permanent, and they find that they aren't made permanent, so they could be there for years and years, part of the furniture, but they don't have that assurance. And I'm sure, we can relate to that. I'm sure many of us can relate to that.
Yeah. And I think it's hard, especially on those 9-month contracts, where, as you say, you have the uncertainty over the summer. The other thing then is academics, sometimes actually I think a little bit like political jobs, because it's a job that you do out of passion. There's almost this feeling that essentially you can be exploited because there's lots of people who are wanting to do that lectureship job. But then, of course, the other thing is, if you're on a 9-month contract, if you're employed in September and it finishes in June, July, then you don't go up the pay scale. So you start again in September and you're on the same scale that you were to begin with.
You're absolutely right. And it also affects career development in other ways. So I'm also a caseworker for UCU. So, you know, obviously get involved, unfortunately, when people haven't had the most positive experience often. So you can have issues around access to research time. And I know, Corey, obviously with your wife, having sort of experience of academia, I'm sure this is all, you know, close to home, but you can have a situation where, as an early stage in your career, that's the time when you really need to be kind of getting the experience under your belt and building up publications and your track record. And how do you do that if you don't have the security of a traditional job, where you would have that teaching that's locked in, that's your bread and butter, but you also have the headspace to put the time in over the summer to do the research that's going to go into that book that's going to get your name out there?
And if you're employed as a teaching fellow, it always seems to me that there's an expectation that you do your research around your teaching. You've not got time to do it. So students, when they know about it, I suppose there's some sort of solidarity there. What about local MPs? So I suppose it's kind of weird. This is going to be lots of obscure Birmingham references, ahoy, because Preet Gill, I suppose, is the MP for Edgbaston, where the university campus is. But Steve McCabe, hashtag stick with Steve, he's the MP.
Great talking, hardworking.
Indeed. For most of the students, I suppose, will live, and probably a lot of staff actually as well, live in the Celio constituency. Have they been supporting the campaign? How have they found dealings with the university?
Again, I wouldn't want to speak for our local MPs and councillors. Obviously, you know, I think we should stress the university, you know, it's a civic university. It's a huge employer, very successful, and I think we all want the university to do well, and I think that's the starting point in our dealings. So the as MPs, as you say, rightly say, the postcode of the university falls in Edgbaston, so it's Preet Gill's patch, but Steve picks up a lot of the student issues. So Steve always likes to say Preet gets maybe in the more glamorous end in terms of the invites, and Steve maybe has more of the issues around Celio/Smelly Oak and dealing with, shall we say, the community relations, you know, and there are really serious issues, I've got to say. It links into marketisation around the development of Celly Oak. And I know Steve's done a lot of good work around building standards and ensuring that students aren't getting ripped off in terms of the quality of the accommodation, and also ensuring that the fabric of the neighbourhoods is protected. So shout out to Steve on his... I've got to say, both Preet and Steve have been very good and very supportive. And obviously, as a Labour activist, I find that very heartening that they have been responsive to both staff and student concerns, not just in the current dispute, but in recent years. Certainly my time as a member of staff, I found them to be responsive when I've written to them as an independent, as a member, of just as a constituent in the case of Steve, and also in my capacity as a rep for UCU. Again, I think they're just sort of, they, along with, I think we most recently, seven Labour MPs wrote to the university, wrote to Sir David Eastwood, to give him his full title, or Professor Sir David Eastwood. And I think they're just a bit scratching their head. You know, I think they feel that so many universities have signed up for the real living wage and accreditation and see value in this. You know, notably both Liverpool and Manchester unis, who are in the same bracket roughly as Birmingham. You would see them as Russell Group.
Yeah.
If people are familiar with that, Red Brick University, so not quite Oxford and Cambridge, perhaps outside of the London.
In many ways better than that.
Yeah, quite. Who's to say? I mean, are we in favour of elitism in education? Discuss. But, you know, they're scratching their head, seeing their peers in the sector are signing up. You know, I believe just recently, I think it was announced that in Wales, all universities have signed up to, as real living wage employers. So it's not controversial. It's not wacky and out there. Dina said the university is well-resourced. That's Sir David Eastwood's own words. We're well-resourced. And Sir David, I think, attributes that to prudent financial management. Why wouldn't you do this? Particularly, and I've got to say, shout out to Liam Byrne on this one, you know, making the case when the West Midlands has some of the highest figures for in-work poverty and soaring demand for food banks, is something that obviously as Labour Party activists we've campaigned on and tried to provide practical solidarity on. Why wouldn't you go that extra mile to ensure that your staff are looked after? The letters which are out in the public domain, I think most recently Steve wrote to Eastwood in July, and then the seven MPs from across the city, including Liam Byrne, Preet and others. Jack Dromey has been very active on this over the years. I think they're told, we're already voluntarily paying the living wage at the university. And then most recently at the hotel, which I think I touched on, they've said we're paying, that the conditions are favourable relative or compared to the hotel sector as a whole, and that they're paying the national living wage. So almost told, we're doing it already, please go away. And I don't think we're ever letting on the thought process, what's so bad about accreditation? And again, it's in a backdrop where the university, I think just in the last 12 months, has very proudly promoted and spoken highly about its accolades and accreditations elsewhere. So notably, its associations with Stonewall, which I could perhaps briefly touch on in relation to the university's controversial Dubai campus, which, you know, the United Arab Emirates doesn't necessarily have the most progressive track record or when it comes to LGBT rights. So we proudly look to Stonewall for accreditation and kite mark, you might call it. Also, there's the Athena Swan, which is the equality in higher education, recognising there's substantial inequalities, notably in gender equality in the areas of science and engineering, for instance. So if those kite marks and accreditations are all good, why on earth is one saying that you pay people enough to live on to not have to go to a food bank not the one to go for? I think they're left scratching their head, quite frankly.
Understandably so. I'm interested in how you're actually able to get the strike process going, because as I understand it, it's incredibly difficult for unions to organise strike action because of changes. I can't remember if it was the coalition or the Tory majority government who brought them in. I think it might have been the coalition
government. I think it was the coalition. Yeah.
But now in a strike ballot, rather than just being a majority of members that go on strike, it's got to be at least 50% of all those eligible to vote have to vote for the strike, don't they, in order for it to go ahead. Which is, especially in internal elections, which don't necessarily get the most publicity anyway, it's an incredibly high threshold. And I'm not sure many MPs actually would meet the threshold of 50% of all eligible constituents voting for them in order to get elected. So there's an interesting dichotomy there. And certainly union bosses, when it was the changes were announced, said it would be almost impossible to get a strike. And yet campaigners at the university were able to do this. How was that?
I think it was the coalition government, the Trade Union Act 2012.
Right.
Union bosses come in for a lot of flack, and perhaps rightly so in some situations. You know, we can all sort of probably share stories being Labour activists.
Yeah, maybe we should do that after the podcast.
That's another one. Yeah, that's for another time.
Who's your favourite? No.
Absolutely. Well, even the term boss, you know, is a questionable choice of words. But
I think you meant to call them union barons, actually.
Yeah, red barons, I believe, or certainly deepest pink. But the legislation was strongly condemned by Liberty, Amnesty International, and other groups. It wasn't simply trade unionists opposing the legislation. I think it's not as bad as it could have been. There were some really important interventions. You know, for instance, monitoring the social media activities of union members was proposed in relation to disputes, which is really sinister when you think about the blacklisting scandal of 10 years ago and the lives destroyed, really, of people who raised legitimate health and safety concerns on building sites where people had died or been seriously injured. So these things don't exist in a vacuum. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think to the outside observer, particularly people who aren't perhaps, you know, haven't gotten experience of being a union member. And I've got to say, I've kind of gained more experience in recent years through austerity, I might add. It sounds entirely reasonable. Oh, well, you know, if you want to take action and cause disruption, well, there should be a high threshold and it shouldn't just be a few troublemakers. But as you say, Corey, mobilising anyone, think of like X Factor, Britain's Got Talent, to go out and vote for anything is actually surprisingly hard. And we try our best with local and national elections as door knockers and with the help of the mighty Stuart and Joan Hosfield. We accomplish some of that, but it is really hard. And I think it strikes a lot of people is deeply unfair that, in a sense, those people who choose not to vote, whether that's through sheer busyness of life, and again, not to condemn anyone, just life's very busy, you might not get around to it, you may not feel well-informed enough, or that you're doing personally okay and you feel that you don't feel it that strongly, those people, in a way, can silence the voice of people who are prepared to take a stand against poverty, wages, and other forms of inequality. So how did Unison achieve that? And again, I'm speaking as a broader kind of campaigner and activist supporting Unison. I'm a Unison member, but not part of the committee, I should stress. So they're the only branch in higher education in the current settlement period who actually met the threshold. So massive shout out to the committee who and the activists and supporters who achieved that. They did that through a number of things. First of all, the strike and this dispute didn't take place in a vacuum. And actually, if you look to America and the Virginia teachers strike, again, there's some interesting parallels there. You know, people who were found to be more militant than people expected. So you're talking about year-on-year frustrations in the backdrop of some people doing very, very well. So there's definitely, I think, Unison were tapping into a feeling of something's got to change this time. In terms of practical stuff, I've been so impressed by the committee and the fact that they're really broad-based in terms of who is on the committee and what parts of the university they are drawn from. So you've got everyone from a guy in his 50s, works in estates, so very much a manual worker, working with his hands, to you've got the student workers, I mentioned sort of the postgraduates doing part-time work to get by, perhaps doing a PhD, perhaps more politically minded, typical activist types. And then you've got the cleaners who have been cleaners, women cleaners, for instance. A lot of our cleaners are women. Again, there's a very strong gendered element about who gets low paid work and who gets high paid work in our society, and that's reflected at the university. So you've got people who are, again, in their 50s and 60s, cleaners who've seen the university through so many different phases and trends, to people who are new members, newly inspired office workers, because again, university, as part of the marketisation, the administration of the university has greatly expanded. You've got people who are responsible filling in grant applications, helping academics comply with the latest research frameworks. I'm sure you're familiar with some of those, Corey. So it's really diverse, I think. And then again, that helps ensure that the committee is listening to its members. It's drawn from those people. So it's picking issues that are truly felt. It's not an obscure cause. That bodes well. So it's the work goes on well before the ballot period starts. And then in terms of some of the specifics, and I'm sure this won't be hugely surprising, but I think data is really important. Making sure that your membership lists are up to date, that you're keeping contact details correct where people move house, because again, linked to the ballot, the government of the day, the coalition government, insisted on it being a postal ballot. So it's either sent to the person's home or place of work. So again, if you're on low pay, you may move more regularly.
So it has to be a postal ballot. It can't be online. No, it has to be post.
Which was one of the things. Now, as a kind of campaign or elsewhere in terms of human rights, there are some interesting arguments about online voting and the security of it.
Mm.
And I'd like to believe that the coalition government was motivated by those concerns about people's rights. But more cynically, you know, there's an issue around suppressing the vote.
But yeah, because just thinking about internal Labour elections, so we eventually will get the chance to vote for our mayoral candidate to take on Andy Street in May, which we're all terribly excited about. That vote in internally is run by a company that's, I think, a subsidiary of the Electoral Reform Society. And so part of that, I think you have to request, that's all online, I think, isn't it? You've got to request a paper ballot. I think usually the expectation is it would go online. So it feels like that's an extra level of
bureaucracy, effectively, that the unions are expected to have to adhere to.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that is a definite example of trying to make life more difficult for trade unions rather than actually it being a fair system which everybody can get behind.
Mm.
Absolutely, and, you know, the thing is, we're all probably, those of us who are kind of politically active, you know, there are always going to be challenges, and I don't want to bleat on about it. You know, ultimately, I take the view that legislation was brought in by a government with a particular agenda, and, you know, you could see its antecedents in sort of, say, Johnson's time as Mayor of London, where he had a very acrimonious dispute with the RMT. I think it was when Bob Crowe
headed up. I had forgotten about Bob Crowe.
Definitely, you can see that as, I certainly see that as politically motivated, the fact that what Johnson was talking about in terms of making it nigh on impossible to take industrial action on the tube. My point is that is another barrier, and particularly in the case of Unison, who differs, the university is slightly unusual in that Unison represent what are called support staff, so generally people who might serve your coffee, cook the food at the university's cafes, but also lower paid administrative staff. But when you get into the higher paid white collar staff, they are represented by UCU, such as academic related staff like myself. So you're talking about people who, by dint of their circumstances, may well find themselves in rental accommodation. And we know that as Labour activists, that makes it harder to stay on the electoral roll if you're moving regularly, because another thing to notify about your details. If you're moving every 12 months or you've got a lot on your plate, it's particularly difficult for that group of people. And that's just a fact. So Unison have done very well, I think, going to do a good job of staying close to the membership, being responsive to their concerns. So first of all, it's focusing on the right campaign issues, because it's not just about real living wage, it's also about the gender pay gap. It's about union recognition as well, that broader point about respect at work. But they did some other things which were good. Keeping the membership data up to date, it's not glamorous work, but really keeping on that so that when the ballot is called, you can get in touch. Innovative methods such as phone banking, which again we're familiar with, text messaging, using text message software to reach people, because again, SMS text may get through in a way that an email doesn't.
Mm.
And actually, I can give you an example of that, how Unison are aware of those issues and planning for that, whereas the university is actually going in the opposite direction. So a text message will get through to a cleaner who has got a Nokia style phone because of the cost aspect, maybe doesn't have much of a data plan. What has the university brought in? Well, they've brought in a purely online payroll system that you have to log onto a computer in order to get your pay slips. Now, if you're a cleaner doing 16 hours a week and you don't have a computer at home or you don't have access to fast broadband, what are you going to do? You're going to have to go and find that computer in the library and print it out. So there's an example of a barrier that the university has either inadvertently imposed or imposed
deliberately.
Not deliberately, but not prioritise the needs.
I suppose it's a structural thing, isn't it? Because I think there's a general move. It's a bit like the voter ID plans almost, isn't it? Like there's almost a move to online only because, well, everyone has a computer, forgetting there are people who don't. And also then the thing of there is no library access because they've all been cut.
And just lastly on that point, so the phone calls, the text message has been very effective, but crucially, really knowing your membership and in getting out there. And a good example, again, as someone who's been supporting the strike action, is about leveraging your personal contact. So unfortunately, probably similar to a lot of workplaces, people feel very nervous about often revealing their union affiliation in the workplace. You don't know who's sympathetic, whether that will be used against you. But I think what I found effective, going back to my old place of work, for instance, and talking to colleagues who were the ones, for instance, in the cafe who served me my coffee, who I had a good rapport with, and saying, hey, I'm helping with Unison. I've been told that your members, talking to them on the QT, and saying, it's really important. I know you may have lost your paper, but you can request a fresh one. We can send it out with 2 days to go. We can do a special recorded delivery. I'll come and pick it up for you. Going that extra mile made a difference. And that shows to people that you really are on their side, you know, and just listening to people's lives, you know, through that experience, I was quite shocked that I learned that one of the women who, again, just served me my noodles at lunchtime. And again, I'm not coming across as corny and wanting to live other people's lives. But this woman, at the end of her week serving me my lunch, was looking after her grandchildren and then going out to work overnight in a older people's care home. So there's someone who's doing a demanding job at a cafe, picking up a lot of domestic responsibilities, and then doing a nighttime job, again, in a very demanding setting, and coming back in on a Monday and having to serve the likes of me, some oik who wants his coffee. It just struck me. And I think that kind of connection makes people think these people are going out to help make sure their voice is heard, and not in a paternalistic way, saying, come out, you've got great ideas, let's build those people. And I'm pleased to say, just as an example, we've recently got new reps appointed at Unison. We've got new health and safety rep, people who are taking on responsibilities, not just looking to the well-established, shall we say, leaders or activists in the brand, saying, like, growing in their confidence to assert themselves. It's been really rewarding.
We talked about outsourcing, I suppose, before, and talking about, obviously, universities are meant to be public bodies. It's not a profit-making institution. It's meant to be for the benefit of the whole of society. And as you say, like, the university is probably one of Birmingham's biggest employers. So it's a huge presence in the city and the region generally. How do we try and bring universities back for that kind of civic good, that kind of social good?
Should stress, we're talking about the University of Birmingham because that's the current campaign, but these are broader questions, you know, for us as a society. You know, what do we see the value of education? What's the purpose of education? Is it about individual self-improvement or the collective, the common good? Or, you know, we could all have a view on that, but definitely there has been a shift. I try to avoid rose-tinted glasses about looking back to some golden age. And actually, if you want to dig into the civic roots of the university, a really good local activist called Josh Allen, who did a project called, I think called Celiac Activist. You may have seen the newspapers a while ago, Corey.
Yeah.
I printed out some newspapers looking at the kind of campaigns that have historically happened in the Celiac area. He's written a really fabulous alternative history of the university in terms of its origin story about the industrialists and their motivations for setting up the university.
Okay.
Which I'll send you the link if you want to include it.
But yeah, sure.
Definitely goes a long way to sort of saying there's two sides to the story in terms of the Chamberlain kind of civic roots and the paternalistic endowing the city with its good, you know, sort of generous benefactors, and perhaps some of the more kind of commercial dimensions to that. But
yeah.
I won't give it away. You definitely read Josh's article. But I think there are a few things.
No spoilers.
No spoilers, yeah. In one way, it's depressing, I guess, that we're talking about we're trying to achieve a real living wage in 2019. So I think we need to sort of definitely focus on achieving living wage accreditation, but see that this should be a floor for our economy. And I think it's really good, actually, that, and there are some encouraging signs, I would say, on a personal note, speaking in a personal capacity as a Labour activist, talk about the National Education Service. The most recent Labour Party conference, there was a resolution, a motion passed around setting up a cooperative university. Now, there's still a lot of flesh to be put on the bones here, but the idea of the university should be run on a cooperative basis. The idea is that the people who work at the university, so the academic and non-academic staff, and also the students who ultimately we're all there for in terms of educating them, should be the stakeholders. I think that would be a really strong way to go, because I think there's a general feeling that, you know, ultimately who's calling the shots at the university? Is it the senior management? Obviously, that's where we've been focusing our dispute, but you could argue that senior management and the upper tiers of leadership are also responding to the incentives that they are given in terms of the frameworks that determine the funding, both in terms of the things, the frameworks I'm thinking, Research Excellence Framework, REF, and also TEF. You may have heard of TEF.
Yes.
There's also one called KEF.
Is that? I've not heard of KEF.
I think it's not worth the time of day. Yeah, I think there's all sorts of frameworks. But, you know, again, it depends where the buck stops. But there's all these kind of pressures to do this. So I wouldn't want to say, again, anyone's making these decisions in a vacuum. But, yeah, I think we do need to look at that. Staff can definitely try their best to stand up, to have a voice, because if you don't join a union and speak out, effectively your employer will speak for you. They'll tell the world that you're perfectly happy to have a below inflation pay rise, that you're perfectly happy to have excessive workloads which are having an impact on people's mental health and family lives, that you're happy to just see a 19% gender pay gap at the university. So nearly 20% difference between what men are paid and what women are paid. Now, there are complex reasons for that gender pay gap. I'm not going to pretend it's simple, but certainly not all good. Rampant casualization, as I said, you know, so those issues. Students, real shout out to the University of Birmingham student workers. As they were organizing over, basically not getting paid over the summer, they found that they were either being paid late or not at all. And it was all through WorkLink, which is the university's sort of employment bank for casual work. The reason for that was that the university introduced a new payment and payroll system, all singing, all dancing administrative system called NewCore, now simply called Core Systems, because it's no longer new, I'm guessing. And basically people found they weren't getting paid. And then when they tried to raise that, let's say people who did get a resolution, they found themselves being made additional payments with emergency tax. So suddenly that doesn't necessarily solve the problem. People getting paid too much or too little, you can imagine. And these students were finding it very stressful, having to go home, borrow money from their parents. Really, really heartbreaking stories from really great people. And they got together, as well as speaking out in the media. They were interviewed by BBC WM and they did a fantastic job, very articulate bunch, mostly led by young female postgraduate students. Very impressive to see. They've made links and forged alliances with the campus trade union. So we at UCE are supporting them, Unison are supporting them, GMB, I'm not sure about Unite, but certainly we're all wishing them well. And they are broadening out their demands. They're saying they want to be treated with dignity on this issue of the payments. Can you pay me, please? But also,
it's kind of important.
Kind of basic, but also the way that they were treated when they tried to basically sort out the payment issues, they felt it was not responded to in a satisfactory way. And that's no reflection on the individual members of staff who had to deal with this higher than usual volume of complaints. I should stress not to blame individuals administering a system, but it's reflective of how they were treated and their place in the pecking order. I think for a lot of us who saw this new system coming in and raised serious concerns, I should say that UCU and the other campus unions raised a number of concerns, and yet the system was rolled out without those assurances being given. So we're seeing this unfold in a reasonably foreseeable way. And who is it impacting? Well, it's impacting the people who can least afford to go without payments. Another good example of that was that the new core system, and this is documented in Redbrick, your old stomping ground, the new system also covers how people are registered for payroll, so their payroll details. And it's based on people's legal name rather than their preferred names. Now, you might think that's fairly dry point, and I did at first, but when you talk to people, and again, we talk to our members all the time, well, what happens if you are a female academic and you got married and you took your husband's name, but you still publish under your maiden name? Well, all of a sudden the system's showing up as your husband's name, which is not helpful for your career and identity. But more seriously, what if you're a trans member of staff or student, and that you have you've transitioned? I think it's called dead naming, when you name people under their name that they prefer not to be used.
Okay.
So the trans student and staff felt that, first of all, a disrespect was being had. Dead naming is seen as very poor form. But more worryingly, their safety could be put at risk, because what if someone saw that I'm kind of helpful in my respect, Frances with an I, Frances is the female version. But what if you're living under a different name and someone rumbles that? And that has a high degree of pertinence in the international context that the university is operating in. The university has got a campus in Dubai, which has got a very, very disconcerting record on LGBT rights. And at the same time as this new system was being rolled out, the university's LGBT network, Rainbow Network it's called, was advising its members to modify their system details to avoid basically personal safety issues. So, for instance, they were saying to people, if your next of kin is your same-sex partner or spouse, change that to a member of your family, put it back to your mum or dad. So you can imagine rolling that out isn't simply affecting, and this is very important, the feelings of a student or a member of staff on an Edgbaston, as serious as that is. It could also have life or death ramifications. So I think what I'd say is, digress, but it's a sign we were raising these issues and others. Domestic violence is another one. You may have changed your name or been living under a different identity because you've fled domestic violence. If that name gets out,
yeah,
what happens? So we thought that was very important, and yet it was rolled out, and so the same system which is screwing up or has screwed up payments also was causing anxiety and distress to our members. Pleased to say, I believe it's called the preferred name system, has now been brought in. But we read about that through the Red Brick newspaper rather than being told about it through the official channels, despite raising that through our official channels. So kind of puts it in perspective that some people are told, others aren't. And I think that's what we're trying to get at, is that we don't pretend there's a magic wand that will solve this, but surely it's better to have a grown-up conversation.
What can people do to help out with the campaign?
There's some really practical things people can do. The Unison members have already taken 6 days of strike action, and nobody takes that lightly. Whatever any politician tells you, nobody takes strike action lightly for the financial impact it has on your family and your well-being, and also the stress on your career. So what you can do is you can make a contribution to the strike fund. So that's a hardship fund that the branch has been very active at reimbursing members where there's hardship or where there's a need to get money quickly, because many people are living week to week or month to month on paychecks. So that really helps. There's a GoFundMe page which you can make an online payment, or I can provide you the contact details that may be in the show notes that you can get in touch with the branch. That's really
crucial. Yeah, we'll show that in the show notes.
So that's, money does help, because after 6 days, it gets very tough to continue. So try and help people continue this campaign till it's settled. The second thing that you can do is you can sign one of the petitions that Unison have been very effective of kind of campaigning on. So the one that most prominent at the moment is the Boycott Edgbaston Park Hotel petition. So the website is boycottEPH.com. And again, I can include the link with you, Corey. And there, what we're asking people to do is to make a pledge. I'm sure we're all familiar with making pledges. So basically, make a commitment that you will not attend any events at the hotel and conference park. So there's a number of venues. It's all listed on the website. So the hotel is the biggest one. Not attend any events. Or if you have a role or a job which might entail organising an event, that you don't organise an event at the hotel until the university makes a solid commitment to bring those staff back in-house. We've seen this work very well in London. There's a campaign called Boycott Senate House, which is still ongoing, but as a result of the pressure and the publicity generated by having high-profile politicians, I think John McDonnell is one of the most high-profile supporters, community leaders commit to the boycott. That put financial pressure on the University of London. And just recently, the new VC of the University of London has said they're now beginning the process of bringing people back in-house. So we think boycotts work. And we should stress that this isn't something that's been thought about lightly. It's after serious concerns have been raised and essentially ignored. And so what are those concerns? It's the pay. The fact is, the staff at the hotel, with the exception of the staff who were transferred and under those TUPE conditions, are paid less than the equivalent staff on campus. So despite the hotel being on campus, essentially, you could be a cleaner in the tower block just next to the hotel and get paid the equivalent of the real living wage, just over £9 an hour. And then the same the same role in the hotel would be paid over a pound less, or approximately, or at least roughly a pound less. For the, so two cleaners separated by 100 yards, and we don't think that's right. And then there's also issues around the treatment of staff. So we mentioned union recognition, which might sound like quite a technical point, but actually, how do you raise concerns in a safe way if you're a low-paid member of staff, perhaps feeling vulnerable? If I speak up about an issue, I may not get allocated the right shift, or I might have my rota changed. Unions actually provide a really important way of having your voice heard at work. So removing union recognition as part of subsidiary. The third point about the hotel is what it says about the future. Okay, we're now talking about a subsidiary company for the hotel, but what's next?
Mm.
The university, as you say, is a massive employer. What about other jobs that could be hived off? So I would say to people, if nothing else, support the campaign to bring it back in-house, because it could be you next. So you may think you work in a relatively well-paid part of the university. You might be white-collar. But what happens when that part of the business is hived off and you suddenly find yourself that you're no longer getting your automatic increment every year, or that you're treated with a degree of fairness? So for those reasons, support those two things. If you can, if you're in a position to donate and support the boycott. And lastly, for the activists listening, as well as signing the pledge yourself, you can pass a solidarity motions through your local branch of Labour Party or other groups that you're part of. And again, we've seen that work well elsewhere. UCU, the union that I'm part of, has already passed a solidarity motion, and we're supporting the boycott. And that can be a really effective way to build pressure, not just here in Birmingham, but nationally.
Hmm. Fantastic. Thank you very much. And we'll put all of those in the show notes.
Fantastic. Thank you.
So we have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. And our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Depper is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm @PaperbackRioter.
I'm @AcousticRadical.
I'm @FrancisClark.
Happy plotting.